So I'll run through my talk, but I would really like it if people just interrupt, and when I, especially when it's really unclear. But any questions that come to mind, that we have 2 hours, and this is supposed to be about a 45, 50-minute talk, so there's lots of time to interrupt. So I do want to talk about the story of GFP. Hold on 1 second. I just have to check something on this. I see. I have to correct something. So you'll see all the things that I'm not going to talk about, but that's the one I didn't want to have hidden. Okay, so now I can go back and do that. And now it makes more sense. Took too many slides out. Anyway, I'm going to talk about the history of this rather remarkable protein. And this is not my first time talking with science teachers, high school teachers, but the first time I was sort of petrified. And I was trying to think of what I should talk about or at least start off. And so I decided that I would describe all the things that I was taught in elementary and high school about science that I now know are completely false and everything. So here are these myths that, and it wasn't that I was actually taught these things, it was just all the examples that were given. You know, I hear about, Newton and Einstein and Darwin. You hear about these people, the greats in science, and you get a certain view about how science is done. And so the first point is that scientists are geniuses, that they are set apart from all the rest of the people in the world because they have this special innate ability to do this work, and they're brilliant. And that, if you don't have that, you may as well just stop instantly and not do anything. So somehow scientists are geniuses, and this ability, they're born with it. The second point is that scientists' experiments work all the time because we don't have time to tell about the failures. We just have time to tell what the great result was. So we just say, and then, you know, Fleming looked at the Petri dish, saw that the mold was getting rid of it. That was it. We got penicillin, you know, boom. Sort of an instantaneous result. The next thing is that, and the reason this all works is that scientists use this peculiar way of thinking called the scientific method. You come up with a hypothesis, you then think of the experiment that's going to test that hypothesis. It works the first time, you publish it, you're famous, and that's the way science is done. So everything's very purposeful. You have the idea, and you go immediately towards it. The other thing about all these scientists that were described, certainly when I was growing up, is that every single one of them did it on his own. And it was, you know, scientists may have had an assistant named Igor, but other than that, that was it. Everybody worked on their own. And the other thing, except for, now this is in the 60s, except for Marie Curie, every single one of these scientists is a white male. Okay, and so that was the image of what science was. European or European descent male, nobody else except for Marie Curie. Now, what I'm going to tell you is that, as you all know, all of these are completely wrong, and the GFP story is a very good example of how all these things are incorrect. So I want to start with how I got involved with this rather interesting protein. I had no idea it existed until 1989 when I was not falling asleep at a seminar as I usually do, but I actually paid attention for the first couple of minutes. And the reason, but I was really primed to hear this seminar, and I'll tell you what the seminar was about in a second, because of the work that I had been doing in the lab for about the previous 10 years or so. I've been working on this small roundworm called Centrorhabditis elegans, C. elegans. We know a vast amount about this. And so I've been working on it for about 10 years. I'm basically a neurogeneticist. I study a set of just 6 cells in these animals that are the cells that sense touch. And we use those cells to actually to investigate 2 basic problems. The first is, how does an organism get a particular type of cell? Out of all the cells that it makes, how does it make this particular cell? That's the problem of differentiation. But the cells that we work on are cells that sense touch. So I'm the world's expert at tickling worms. And I've tickled a very large number of them. But why would I want to do that? Well, the reason I was doing all this tickling of worms, I should say, the animal's only a millimeter long. So the way you test touch is you take an eyebrow hair that you glue onto a toothpick, and you tickle it, you draw it across the tail, or you draw it across the head, and it moves in the other direction. And it's easy to get mutants that don't respond when you do this. Now, you have to differentiate those from the ones that are already dead, but basically, we look at animals that will not move when we touch with a hair. That's the gentle stimulus. But if we hit them a little harder, they'll move. We have a little wire that we move them around with. So why are we interested in touch? Well, scientists over the years have learned how we interact with the world around us through our various senses. And we've known for about 130 years or so that the molecule that allows us to detect light outside of us is the molecule rhodopsin. So we've known about that receptor for light for a very long time. The other senses have taken a lot longer for us to sort out. So it was only in the last 30 years that we've been able to understand chemical signaling, both in terms of odor detection, our sense of smell, and also detection of chemicals within the body. And Richard Axel here won a Nobel Prize for the olfactory receptors with Linda Buck, who was working in his lab. So we've known about how chemical signaling is detected. But we have a whole series of senses that don't work chemically or are not activated by light. These are senses that are mechanically driven. And we have quite a large number of these. Hearing is one of these, where the sound waves get changed in the ear to a fluid wave that then gets detected by the hair cells in the inner ear that move around. So it's the movement of those hairs that allows us to hear. When you spin around fast, you have your vestibular hair cells that are detecting the acceleration as you spin. There are something like 5 different types of cells in our skin that detect touch. We have cells that detect blood pressure. When you go to the doctor and the doctor hits you in the knee and you do that reflex, what the doctor is really doing is by hitting here is stretching the muscle. A stretch receptor in the muscle detects that stretch, sends a signal to the spine, which then says the muscle's too long. The motor neurons then activate the nerve cell. It contracts, and you kick up your leg. What the doctor is doing is testing how long it takes for that reflex to occur, but it's all driven mechanically, that stretch receptor. And we have receptors in our tendons and in our muscles. So we have quite a large number of these mechanically activated senses, and they all have basically one thing in common, or they certainly did when I started my work, and that is nobody had a clue as to how they worked. So the idea was we could take this animal, find mutants that were touch insensitive. Now, some of those mutants were going to be insensitive because the cells weren't made. So those would tell us about that problem of differentiation, how the cells were generated. But others, the cells would be made, but they wouldn't work at all as touch sensors. And those, we hoped, would give us the molecules that were needed for touch sensitivity. And we got a lot of mutants, and we actually did find the first, and were able to prove, the first touch sensor in an animal. But I'm not really going to talk about that except to say that as we were doing those experiments, we, you know, get mutants, clone the genes that were defective in the mutants, and then we wanted to study those genes. And one of the first questions we wanted to ask was, where is the gene turned on? What cells activate that gene? And we have this nice animal that's transparent. And these are really the two important things, that the animal is transparent, and second, we were interested in asking where are genes expressed. Now, at the time, which is about 1988 or so, 89, there were methods to answer this question. And that, among the ways of doing things, where we could make an antibody against the protein that was encoded by the gene and then ask where is the protein. Or we could take the promoter region, the control region for the gene, and instead of having it make the protein, have it make a reporter, like the LACZ gene encoded beta-galactosidase. Or we could actually look for the RNA that was made from the gene. If the gene was turned on, it had to make messenger RNA. And we could see that by in situ hybridization. So all of these existed, and as you can see in these pictures, they all worked. And they showed us that the six touch cells were the ones that did express this particular gene. The problem with all of this is that it was a lot of work. What we had to do in all of these cases was to take the animal and prepare it for the experiment, which meant killing it, fixing it so things didn't move around, and then permeabilizing it to get stuff inside, either getting the antibody inside the animals or the substrate for the enzyme that would tell us the enzymatic activity, or getting the DNA or RNA probes into the animal for the in situ hybridization. So we had to fix and permeabilize the animal. And the problem with this, of course, is that it gives you a very static view of what's going on. You do it once, then you got to do it again, and you got to repeat it. And you don't see anything changing because you've already killed the organism. And so we wanted something else, and we needed some inspiration. Before I go into the inspiration, I want to talk about the color code that I always use on my slides. Anyone, as these two people, whose names are in red were people in my laboratory or are in my laboratory. Anybody whose name is in blue is a collaborator, and anyone whose name is in black did something I wish I had done. So, as I say, we needed some inspiration, and actually one of the most wonderful examples of inspiration I know of is this wonderful cartoon by Nick Kim. Cambridge 1953, shortly before discovering the structure of DNA, Watson and Crick, depressed by their lack of progress, visit the local pub where one of the patrons says, "I'll have a double Felix." My inspiration didn't come in a pub. It came in this seminar that we had every Tuesday at noon, and I heard about the work of this man, Osamu Shimomura, who shared the prize with me in 2008. He has a rather remarkable story, and one that I encourage everybody to go and, it's only 29 minutes to listen to him say it, but you could read his autobiography or read the speech at the NobelPrize.org site, and it's a really remarkable story. At the age of 16, he's told, you have to quit school. He's in 10th grade, you have to quit school, and you have to work in a factory. So he quits school, he's sent to work in a factory. It's on the other side of the mountains from the city he's grown up in, which turns out to be actually a pretty good thing, because the city he grew up in was Nagasaki, Japan. And by being on the other side of the mountains, he saw the flash of the atomic bomb, but he was basically protected about it, although he does talk about walking home in what was referred to as black rain that day and having his grandmother insist that he wash all this stuff off and everything. And he went in and he cared for people. But after the war was over, he didn't have a college to go to. Couldn't go to college because the college had been destroyed, and basically people went to their local college. But they finally built, started rebuilding, and they built near where he was living, so he could go to it, the pharmacy school. He did not want to go to pharmacy school, but it was the only college available to him, and so he went there, graduated, and then got a job at Nagoya University doing research. And he went to the lab, and what happened to him is something that is really quite remarkable, but the beginning is not that surprising. He was given a project to work on that had already been tried by several people, and they had all failed on it. So it was sort of like, oh, we'll give the new guy the project that we know isn't going to work and see what he does. And what that project was to discover the enzyme in a small crustacean called Cypridina that was a bioluminescent organism. So the idea was, could you find the protein, the enzyme, that generated light in this crustacean? Now, there's at least 50 or so different species and 20 different phyla that can actually generate light. Fireflies, glowworms, bacteria, crustaceans, jellyfish, fungi, all sorts of interesting organisms produce light, and they all do it differently. So the idea of working on this crustacean, everything from the past was of no use, and he went, and he got it to work. And this got him two things. It got him an invitation to come to work at Princeton with a guy named Frank Johnston. And it also, the head of the lab gave him as a going away present his PhD, which is a rather remarkable little thing. And anyway, so Shimomura goes to Princeton, and he and Frank Johnston then go to Friday Harbor Lab in Washington State, and they're going to try to figure out the molecules involved in producing light in this jellyfish, Aquaria victoria. And so then there's some sort of disagreement on how to proceed, and Frank Johnston goes off and does what he's going to do. And then Shimomura basically is working on his own. And he constantly is trying to, you know, they're getting hundreds and thousands of jellyfish, grinding them up, trying to figure out what the enzyme is, and nothing is working at all. And this is where the scientific method comes in. One night, he's frustrated again. He's worked all day. The experiment has not worked still another time. It's late at night. It's dark outside. He takes the prep, and he cleans up after himself. He throws it in the sink. The sink had the discharge from all the aquaria that they had where they were keeping the jellyfish and everything. So there was a lot of seawater coming in. And so he throws his stuff in the sink, and he's just about to leave. He turns off the light, and he looks back at the sink, and it's glowing brilliantly. And he thinks about that for a second, and he realizes that because of the seawater, there was probably something in that seawater that was not in any of his preps. He thought, well, it's probably calcium, which is in seawater and had never been in his prep. And he tries it, and sure enough, that's it. And he's able then very quickly to purify the protein, which he names after the jellyfish, and it's called aquarin. And he realizes that calcium plus aquarin will produce light. So that's the first accident. The second problem that he solves, the second sort of accidental discovery, however, is the fact that it's the wrong color. That the jellyfish are green, but this protein, when activated, when calcium is around, produces blue light. And so he thinks about that for a while and says, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. There must be something else, something that converts the blue light to green. And so he takes a handheld mineral light, a UV lamp, and he goes to all his samples again, and he finds one, not the one that had aquarin, but another one, and he finds that the ultraviolet light actually activates this, and he gets this green glow out of the test tube. And he writes up the paper on the purification of a corn, and in the paper, he mentions, I think it's footnote number 3, that there's this other protein that he called the green protein, and that we now call green fluorescent protein, or GFP, and that when that's present, now what's produced is the green light. And the GFP is a protein that is fluorescent in the sense that it takes light of one color, blue or ultraviolet, and converts that to green. So something like this. This is actually what the molecule looks like, which is pretty astonishing. And so I'm listening in this seminar, and I remember I'm working on a transparent animal, and an animal that I really want to know where the genes are expressed. And we've had to fix them and do all these things, and I realized that if we could get this protein into the animal, all we would have to do is shine blue light on the animal. And because it's transparency, wherever the gene was turned on making this, we would see green, and we'd be able to detect the cells. In other words, that this, and I want to go back and forth between this picture, but that it would basically be working as a lantern, a way of marking the cells. And I have to say, when George Phillips and, Remington, first got the structure. The structure is an astonishing structure. This is, there's 11 of these strands, these beta strands here. They make a cylinder. The tops of these things sort of fold in on top. And right down the center, or right up the center, either way, is this alpha helix. And the important part to make the molecule is right in the center, and I'll talk about that in a second. So it really does look like a molecular lantern. It really is quite astonishing. So I heard about this. Actually, I've taken longer to tell about this than the person who, Paul Brehm, whose seminar I listened to. But I got very excited about this, and as a result, I cannot tell you anything about what he said for the rest of his seminar. I just sat there and fantasized about all the experiments I would like to do if I could do this. And I realized I had to find out who was doing the molecular biology. Could I get my hands on this gene so we could put them into worms? And I did what any self-respecting scientist would do. I got on the telephone and started asking people. And so I found that this man, Douglas Prasher, was in the process of isolating the cDNA for GFP. He had actually already, as a postdoc, isolated the cDNA for a corn, and now this was going to be the next step. And I called him up. We had a wonderful conversation where it turned out we both had the same idea, and we wanted to get this to work, and we set up a collaboration, and then we lost track of each other. He called saying that he had finally finished the cloning the year that I was away on sabbatical. So I missed hearing him. But in 1992, we had a new graduate student enter the department, Gia Skirkin, and Gia had already gotten a master's degree in chemical engineering working on fluorescence. So I told her about this idea I had of using green fluorescent protein, and I figured she knew about fluorescence. This was going to be terrific. It'd be a good rotation project as she started into graduate school. And she was going to do this, and as we're talking, I said, well, you know, the university has just put Medline, sort of precursor of PubMed, on our computers. Let's look and see if there's any papers on fluorescent proteins, which I hadn't done for the 3 years before. And we found that earlier that year, Douglas had already published the sequence of GFP. It hadn't worked to give him fluorescence, but or he didn't, I guess he looked, or I'm not even sure if he looked, but I called him up. We got back together in terms of the collaboration, and he sent the material to us. And 1 month after Gia started graduate school, so this is the case where the first time the experiment worked, although it took 3 years for us to find each other again. But Gia, this is a page from her lab notebook where she put it into bacteria, say they're strongly fluorescing, and this is actually a picture she took of those fluorescing bacteria on that very first day. Now, the other interesting thing about this page from her lab notebook is that she says here that she used the microscope from the engineering school because she had gotten her master's in the engineering school on fluorescence. She knew where there was a good microscope. Our microscope was a piece of junk. It had too much glass in the light path, and she looked at the bacteria in it and thought, maybe it worked, maybe it didn't work, I don't know. But I know where there's a much better microscope. So she went, she did that, that's where she was able to take the picture. And so then there was a lot of jumping around and excitement because it had worked. But this left us with a real problem because we couldn't keep going over to that other lab to use the microscope. And there was one better fluorescence microscope in our department, but we also couldn't really use that after a while because other people needed to use it because it was attached to our confocal microscope. And so the way I solved this problem is I called up all the microscope representatives in New York, sales reps, and I said, we've just discovered a new way to look at gene expression, and I'm going to buy myself a new microscope. But before I decide which microscope I need to buy, I'd like to try them out. So if you could bring a microscope by, and if you could leave it for a month or two, that would give us enough time to really just... So all the experiments were done on borrowed microscopes. After the paper came out, we actually did buy one. But let me tell you how wonderful this result was. And if you had asked anyone in the field if this was going to work, they would have said, absolutely not. And let me explain why everyone in the field was convinced that this was a very stupid experiment. GFP starts off like all polypeptides as a string of amino acids. And this one part here, you see the peptide backbone goes through like this. But GFP, as opposed to virtually every other polypeptide, undergoes a rearrangement such that, if you look right here, you produce a five-membered ring. And this is absolutely critical for the production of the fluorescence, because it enlarges the resonance area here quite a bit. So without that rearrangement, this can't work. But no one knew how the rearrangement took place. Did it require one converting enzyme, or three, or 10? No one had a clue. So we knew that at the time, from Shimamura's work, that the polypeptide was all that was needed. No other cofactor needed to be added, but no one in the field knew how it was made. We made a gamble that it wouldn't need anything, and Gia's experiments say that it doesn't need anything. But I want to remind you, the basic idea in the field was, this is not going to work. You're going to have to get this, and then you're going to have to find the converting enzyme to make it work. And it might be more than one. I now know that there were at least three other groups that were trying this same experiment. They had the same idea to do this. Our experiment worked, as I said, the first time. So we knew there was nothing else that was needed. The other three groups did the experiment, and it did not work. And so they concluded that there had to be something else that was needed. And therefore, it was an uninteresting tool, because you just want a tool that you can just add. You don't want to have a tool you have to construct in an organism, and so on. How did we get these very different results? It turns out that sloppiness is really important. Okay? So let me explain the idea here. This is the clone that Douglas Prasher had got. Now, there's bacterial bits, the bits in black, but there was a coding sequence, and that's in green. So all the coding sequence for the amino acids in GFP are here in green, diagrammed here in green. But the cDNA from the jellyfish had some extra bits, the parts that are in red. Now, there are basically two ways that you could get this DNA and put it in some other construct that you want to make. And one of those, the tried and true method, the one that's not messy, the one that is accurate and you don't screw up the sequence at all, is to have restriction enzyme cuts that will cut the thing right out. But you're constrained by where those restriction sites are. And when Douglas made this, he had these ECOR1 sites at the two ends. The other three groups did this. I didn't like the idea of taking anything other than the green part. And so I suggested to Gia that she not do that, but make primers for PCR, polymerase chain reaction, and amplify just the sequence that was the coding sequence, and then put that into the vectors that we were going to use. But I have to remind you that in 1992, PCR was really quite error-prone. You copied a sequence, and a lot of times there'd be errors, and those would then be propagated. So you could get a lot of bad copies. Now, you also had a lot of good copies, but you had a lot of bad copies. It was a mess. But what did we want to do? We wanted to put this into bacteria to see if it worked. So I didn't care if half or even 3/4 of the bacteria didn't work because they had the wrong sequence. As long as some of the bacteria had the right sequence in it, we would be able to see if it was fluorescent. And that's what happened. So a lot of times it didn't, you know, a lot of the bacteria didn't have any fluorescence, but enough, more than enough did for us to see that this worked on its own. So we were very lucky that we decided to be careful in terms of what we were taking out of this, but very messy in the experiment. So we knew it worked. We then put it into worms and decided that it was time. And then, because I can't basically keep my mouth shut, told a bunch of people, and they were starting to use it. We decided it was time to write this up, submitted it to the journal Science, and it did get published. Now, I have to tell you a little bit about the problems of scientific publication. So the first thing is, the people at the magazine Science have an just have this incredible idea about their importance. So they don't just take papers and then submit them to reviewers and say, what's your opinion? They have to first decide whether they're going to submit the paper for review. It's got to pass them as the gatekeepers. And they called me up and they said, we're sorry, we're not going to send this paper out to review as it is. And I said, well, what's the problem with it? And they said, well, you see, we don't like the title. And I said, well, what's wrong with the title? Green fluorescent protein, a new marker for gene expression. And they said, well, you see, at the journal Science, everything is new. So you cannot use the word new or novel. You have to take that word out. You have to change the title. And I said, well, if I change the title, will you send it out? I think they may have said maybe. I'm not really sure. But I don't like being told what to do, so it really ticked me off. So you can see my anger and frustration in the title that went into the paper that the reviewers see. The Acoria Victoria green fluorescent protein needs no exogenously added component to produce a fluorescent product in prokaryotic and eukaryotic cells. This is actually the entire paper, right? They could just read the title and that would be the end of it. And it got accepted, even though one of the reviewers did say that time-honored line, well, they haven't learned anything new. In other words, we didn't use the technique to actually learn about another problem that we were, anyway. But it got accepted. And then the copy editor called me up and said, do you know that your title is a little long? Could you shorten it? And I said, oh, yeah, I think so. How's this as a title? Green fluorescent protein as a marker for gene expression. And that was accepted. The next problem was that I had taken this picture. It's a little hard to see here, but this is actually a living, newly hatched worm. And this is a nerve cell, and that's its growth cone. It's growing out. We're actually watching something happen in a living animal. And that's what I wanted people to know about. And I thought this would make a very nice picture for the cover. And the cover editor called me up and said, you know, we really like your picture. We want to use it on the cover. However, there's one color we really don't ever like to use, and that's green, because it just doesn't reproduce very well on the cover. And it's true. This is a sort of enhanced picture. The cover is not very beautiful. But I insisted that it would be green, and they kept it in. The third problem, and last I'm going to talk about scientific publication, is, as I said, we had already given out samples to people. In fact, those of us in the worm field, we have a newsletter called the Worm Breeders Gazette. And I had actually put something into the October, this was February 94, in the October 93 issue, October 1st, we had a page saying, we have this marker, anyone that wants it, here's, just send us a letter. This is how you can get it. And so we had been giving this stuff away, and then other people heard it from others. And so we were sending this off to a lot of people. Ultimately, we actually sent off something like 1,500 samples to people. But some people were very nice. They got back to me, and they said, you know, it worked. And I said, well, that's great. We're writing up the paper now. Can I cite your results as unpublished data? And all but one person said it was absolutely fine. Go ahead. And they're actually listed in the paper. One person gave me a hard time, this one. Dear Marty, is perfectly fine with me if you cite S. Wang and my unpublished results in your science paper, provided you meet the following conditions. You make coffee each Saturday morning for the next 2 months, ready at 8:30 a.m. You prepare a special French dinner at the time of your choosing, and you empty the garbage nightly for the next month. That's my wife. What Tula did was really remarkable, because what we had done is we had taken that control region of the gene, the promoter region, the upstream region, and we had put that with GFP, so whenever that gene was turned on, it would make GFP. What she did is she took the controlling region and the protein coding region and then added GFP. So now, whenever the protein was made, it would have this lantern hanging onto it. So wherever the protein went, she would be able to see it. So we were looking at just what cell is the gene expressed in. She was looking at where did the protein go. And she was studying early development of the developing oocyte in fruit flies, in Drosophila. And she was studying a protein that was made, as you can see here, by the GFP, in what are called the nurse cells. And it's transported through what are called these canals coming through here, and comes to lie along this edge and here. And she could watch the particles break up and move in and have these things accumulate. She could watch the whole thing happening and look at the protein. So we talk about these things. These are looking at a transcriptional fusion, that is looking at where the gene is turned on or not, or a translational fusion where you can see where the protein is going. So she made the first one. So I did want to cite her stuff. This was actually just an internal letter. This is not the letter she sent to science saying that we could do it. But there's been a lot of debate about whether I've actually ever paid this bet or met these conditions. And actually, she mentioned this yesterday, as a matter of fact. I will tell you that for many people, this is the only thing they remember of my talk. About 2 years ago, I gave a talk at the Indian National Science Congress, and there was a reporter, and this is the only thing he wrote about in his report of my talk, was this. And as everybody who lives in New York knows, that you on your block, you either have a couple of Starbucks or you have a couple of Duane Reeds. Well, we have a Duane Reed pharmacy near that we go to. And I went in there about 3 or 4 months after the Nobel, and one of the pharmacists said to me, "Wait a minute, aren't you the guy who won that Nobel Prize?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "Well, congratulations." I said, "Thank you." And then a few months later, my wife went in, and she was getting something, and either that guy or somebody else, one of the other pharmacists, said to my wife, "Wait a minute, aren't you the wife of that guy who won the Nobel Prize?" And she went, "Yeah." And he looked at her and he said, "I loved your letter." In any case, GFP, once we showed it could be in bacteria and in worms, and other people, she had shown it was in flies. Roger Chen's lab showed it could go into yeast. There were people that had already put it into human cells and culture that we reported in our first paper. It was going to go into everywhere, basically. And it has. And this is sort of a rogues gallery of some organisms with this. So that upper left-hand corner is, I should maybe use the pointer. This is GFP in the nervous system of this nematode, C. elegans. There's only 302 nerve cells, but we're lighting up every single one of them. This is fruit fly, canola plant, mice, zebrafish. This is Alba, the GFP bunny that was made by a French biotech company for the Brazilian artist Eduardo Koch so that he could go to, he had it as a family pet, but he also would bring it to his art installations to get people talking about the connection between art and technology or art and science. Over here on the right are some examples of cells, some in culture. This is Drosophila. This is the plant Arabidopsis thaliana. This is a mouse Purkinje cell. And you can see one other advantage of GFP, which I'll mention in a moment, and that is that GFP is actually going everywhere in the cell. Beta-galactosidase, the other reporter that I mentioned a while ago, that's 16 times larger in molecular weight, and it never gets out of the cell body unless you do little tricks with it. And so it doesn't outline the cells. GFP definitely outlines all the cells. GFP has been put into bacteria, archaea, fungi, plants, animals, all sorts of organisms. The only organism that does not seem to have GFP put in it as of yet, except for one, is human, and except for one example that came out a couple of years ago, and that's this person. If you look at Ang Lee's movie, Hulk, which I think is 2004, something like that, you will see that it starts off with these jellyfish bobbing along, and a hypodermic comes in and just sucks out the GFP, and that's it. Shimamura should have known that, right? Just suck out the GFP right from the jellyfish. And there's some other things in the credits, but it's to lead you to believe that this is really the first human GFP transgenic, and that somehow the gene for GFP got interspersed in some gene that's turned on with anger. So whenever it's activated, then the skin goes green. And everything. And the screenwriter for Ang Lee, James Shamus, is at our School of the Arts here at Columbia. And it turned out that his daughter and my daughter went to elementary school together. So when this movie came out and my students said, "You got to see this," I went and saw it and I called him up and I said, "James, this is really amazing. My students had me see your movie. This is great. How did you know about my work?" And he said, I have no idea what you work on. And I said, well, the GFP. And he said, how'd you know about GFP? And he said, oh, that. We had a guy working on the set from MIT, and he told us about it. That's how it got in the movie. Okay, so why is GFP, why were people excited about GFP? First of all, you put it in an organism by transforming the animal and giving it its GFPs, or the organism. So it can be in the plants or bacteria or any of these organisms. As long as you get the DNA in, that DNA will encode the making of the protein. What this means is that you don't have to redo it every time. You do it once and you have the organism, and all of its progeny will have this as well. And so it will be able to be maintained. You don't have to remake it. This allows a lot of experiments that I'll get into in a moment. When we do the experiments, not only aren't we killing the animals, but we're really not harming them much at all because we're shining blue light on them, and that's pretty innocuous. And so it is sort of an essentially non-invasive way of looking at what's going on in an organism. I've already said something about the small size allowing it to go throughout the cells, and also pointed out really one of the most important aspects here is because of all of this, we can look at GFP in living organisms. We finally have a dynamic way of looking at biological processes, which are inherently dynamic, instead of the static way we had with those other methods. So I want to show you two movies, and those movies rely on some facts about cell division. In this case, actually not cell division, but nuclear division, because it's in the very beginning of fruit fly development, and in the beginning of fruit fly development, the nuclei divide. There's no cell division that takes place. But during the division of a nucleus, the nuclear envelope breaks down, the chromosomes line up, and they're separated, and then the nuclear envelope reforms. And the separation of the chromosomes takes place on this array of microtubules called the spindle. That's all you need for these two movies, to know about the spindle and about the nuclear envelope, because I'm going to show you two movies. The first one uses GFP attached to a protein that's part of the spindle. So you're going to be able to see the spindle through successive rounds of nuclear division. The other movie I'm going to show you has GFP now attached to a small peptide called the nuclear localization signal. So when there is a nucleus, the GFP gets sucked up into it, and that's where you see the GFP. But out when this breaks down, it will go all over the embryo. Okay? So let me go to the movies. And the one on the left is the one for the spindle. Let me get that started. We'll watch it a little bit. This is very speeded up. And both of these were made by Rosalind Silverman Gavrilla, who at the time was a graduate student in Canada and put these on the website of the American Society for Cell Biology. One more division now. Now, as you look at this movie, I will tell you her title for it, and that is In Synchrony. And as you can see, all of these divisions are taking place simultaneously. And that's rather remarkable. How does that take place? So being able to have this dynamic view of what's going on immediately starts to invite the question of what is the control over this synchronous pattern of division. So I'll let that run, and we'll go to the other one. Now, this is, as you can see, a bunch of colors. It's all false color. So the convention for false color is the least amount is the blue end of the rainbow, the most amount is the red end of the rainbow. So you get blue or green and yellow, orange, and red mean that there's more of it. So here are the nuclei. So this is before the cell division, the nuclear division takes place, and all the GFP is inside the nuclei. So now we'll watch a couple of divisions here. Now it's all over, because the nuclei are dividing. Now the nuclei are reforming and the GFP is coming into the cells. Then they break down because division is taking place, and it's again all over the embryo, and this is going to follow through again. Now, she caught...
What embryo is that?
This is also Drosophila. It's the same... It's not the same Drosophila embryo, but it's about the same time. And again, greatly speeded up. Now, the interesting thing here is that it's not synchronous. That there's this wave that seems to go in this direction. And so it's a question of how do you get synchrony here and not synchrony in this embryo when they were doing when she was doing these experiments. We believe that it was that this one is slightly damaged and it's causing a problem in terms of this. And but we're not really sure. A friend of mine and I have a bet about what it is, but neither one of us wants to actually go and do the experiment. We're busy with other things. People are constantly using this to look at how, as my wife first did, to show proteins going from one place in an organism to another place, seeing that change. People seeing proteins that go into the nucleus or out of the nucleus according to different conditions. There's a recent series of experiments by a guy named Tony Hyman at the Embl Lab. Now he's at Max Planck. And Tony has been looking at something that people have known for hundreds of years. And that is that in germ cells, especially in insects, there are regions that, sometimes called pea granules or germplasm. And these are things that are absolutely needed for the production of sperm and egg. They're needed for the production of the gametes. And people have always talked about these as granules. He finally labeled them about a year or so ago. And when he labels them, he finds that they don't look like granules at all. They actually look like liquid that keeps changing its shape and being molded and everything. It's giving a completely different view from the static view of what was happening. When people look at mitochondria, what they find is that mitochondria, and people had inklings of this before GFP, but with GFP it's much easier to see. Mitochondria, which in every single textbook are described as these sort of lima bean-shaped organelles in the cell, are actually organelles that are constantly fusing with one another and coming apart. And this fusion and separation is absolutely critical, that when that's blocked, the cells die. And it looks like, at least perhaps in Parkinson's disease, that this fusion cycle is somehow disrupted. Whether that's causative or not, no one knows, but it looks like an interesting way to go and look at this. And only by looking at things dynamically do you get a chance to see these differences that are occurring. Now, GFP has been used in many labs in many ways. I'm going to give you a brief description of some of the things we've done in the lab. We use GFP to ask where is a gene expressed. So these are two genes, MEK17 and MEK15. My middle initial is not E, but these stand for mechanosensory genes number 5 and 17. And when they're, and so we want to know, but both of these have only one defect. You get rid of the gene, the animals are touch insensitive. But MEK17 is expressed in the 6 touch sensing cells. MEK5 is not expressed in those cells at all. It's expressed in the adjacent muscle. So we now are interested in what's that interaction between the muscle and the nerve cells that's important for this. We have some ideas of what we think that is. We also look at to ask where is protein made in the cells. So MEK4 is a protein that is that transducer, that receptor of touch. This is the thing that's activated by touch and allows the cell to work. And it's not uniform. It's in this very nice dotted pattern, which immediately raises the question, what do those dots represent and how are they established? We also use this to isolate cells. We label an animal like this, or actually we take an embryo, we break apart thousands of embryos, make a cell suspension, and then we put it through a machine called the fluorescence activated cell sorter. If you've ever taught the Millikan experiment with the water droplets and the charge and moving the drop, that's what a fluorescence activated cell sorter is. Each drop has a cell in it. There's a laser that hits the cell with the appropriate light. If it's fluorescent, there'll be an output that's the green output, and a charge will be put on that drop, and it'll be dumped into one test tube. Everything else will go through. And so you can separate out the cells from all the others, and we've done that, and this is actually touch cells, touch sensing cells in culture, just before we do the experiment to separate them from everything else. But to me, all of these have been very useful, it's very good. The single most important thing for our work has been to take this animal, and as I said, all of its progeny, and mutate it, and ask, can we find animals that have changes, because now we can see the cell. And so when you look at this, the cells are actually pretty simple. They have a cell body, a long process that goes up towards the front. This one has this process here. This one is down like that. This one's a little hard to see. It's very faint right here. There's two here, one on each side. Very simple. So there's six cells in the animal. We've looked and we found animals that have fewer cells, animals that have more cells. What regulates that? By having these mutants, we can start studying that. Or we can ask questions of, these cells have a process that grows out in the back. These cells do not. How does that come about? And we found genes that affect that. Or affect the branching that takes place. So number, branching, position of the cells. All of these things are important for the final production of this appropriate cell in the appropriate place and in the appropriate number. And we have a way of looking at for those mutants simply by looking down the microscope at animals that are the progeny of mutated animals and just finding the things that look strange, because we've been able to label the cells with GFP. And so we've found a lot of mutants. So GFP has been very useful, but basically scientists are pretty greedy, and they always want more, and they want something different. And one of the things people really wanted more of were different colors, so you could label more than one thing. And that's where Roger Chen came in. He also made a much stronger GFP version. And he made eventually a variety of these things. Actually, he made a blue and a yellow-green, and then these Russian scientists, Lukianov and Maps, they really loved to scuba dive. And they knew that corals were fluorescent. And so they went and said, there must be a fluorescent protein, much like GFP, in the corals. So let's see if we can find it. And they did. And they got the first red fluorescent protein. So now with red fluorescent protein and all these, now we have an amazing amount of colors, many of them made by Roger's lab. And so they actually span now the entire spectrum. He got tired of calling them by letters, RFP for red fluorescent protein and YFP for yellow fluorescent protein, and started calling them after fruits. I think this is blueberry, melon, lime, lemon or banana, I'm not really sure, orange, and that's either tomato or cherry. And he has about 13 or 14 of these things here. And, you know, if you have a bunch of colors, you can then label many things. And in fact, you know that we only have three color receptors in our eyes. So, and we can see all the colors. So you could probably mix and match these things. And in fact, Josh Sames and Jeff Lichtman at Harvard, in fact, did this. They took four of the colors spanning the entire spectrum, and they put promoters so that any nerve cell would have a random chance of having some of the four turned on. And so there'd be a whole mix. Every nerve cell would have a different label. And they labeled the mouse brain, and therefore, because it was the whole spectrum and they were looking at the nervous system, they called it Brainbow. And these are some of their pictures. And they're really quite remarkable. And as you know, there's been this big call for mapping the human brain and understanding the nervous system in mammals. And among other tools, this is a very useful tool for things like this. Roger had another idea which was very useful, and that he wanted to use this for. And that is a feature of fluorescent molecules. And this feature of fluorescent molecules is called Forster resonance energy transfer. And so what happens is this. If you have a construct now that has two fluorescent proteins, one that when stimulated produces blue and one that produces yellow, if you shine ultraviolet light on the blue on the molecules, that won't activate this, or essentially won't activate this, but it will activate the blue molecule, and you'll get blue light coming out of it. A little bit of that blue light will go over and hit the yellow fluorescent protein, which is activated by the blue light, and so it'll produce a little yellow. Two random molecules, you know, one's sort of emitting light in all directions, very little blue is actually going to hit the yellow molecule. However, if the molecules are close together, and they basically have to be touching, then this unusual phenomenon occurs in which you activate with ultraviolet light as before, but blue light is essentially not made. The activation of the blue molecule is transferred to the yellow molecule, and that produces, so very little blue light comes out, but a lot of yellow light comes out. And so, as I said, it's called Forster resonance energy transfer, or FRET. Sometimes people call it fluorescence resonance energy transfer. And Roger realized that this would be an exceptionally wonderful tool, because all of this can be encoded in the DNA, and you can put this in an organism. And the first thing he made is actually the thing I've diagrammed here. What this bit is in the middle is a couple of polypeptides that bind calcium, the little red dots here. And so when calcium is around, this thing rearranges and brings these close together. So this is a way of measuring calcium in the cell, in a living cell, because if there's no calcium, you're going to get mainly blue light. If there's a lot of calcium, you're going to get yellow. And you're going to get a range of these things. So you actually, if you use these right, play with them a little bit, you can actually use them to measure the amount of calcium that's in cells. And people have been doing this now for several years. But these molecular monitors, this way of using FRET as a way of reading out something going on in cells, has now become a little cottage industry. So there are hundreds of these molecular molecules that detect pH, the oxidation state of the cell, a lot of different enzymatic activities. I'll give you one example of an enzymatic activity, a protease. So if you put a peptide that's going to be cut, before it's cut, the fluorescent proteins are very close together. You're going to get mainly yellow. But once it's cut, they're going to diffuse away from each other. You're going to get mainly blue. And so you have a way of looking at when that protease is starting to act. So, as I said, GFP has been used in a lot of different instances. A couple of years ago, I went online to look at just one journal, Journal of Cell Biology. This is the first issue in 2010. And there were 11 research articles in this issue, and 9 of the 11 use GFP. And some of them more than once. And I like to say that I'm still working on these two people to have them see the light, so to speak. But it's been really remarkable of how many people have done this. It's very hard to know how many papers have actually come out because of GFP or other fluorescent proteins. If you look in PubMed and do GFP, YFP, and RFP, for example, you come up with about 36 to 40,000 papers. But I recently talked to someone at Chemical Abstracts, and they actually count, they look at every word in the thing, and her latest count, which was, well, the count that she gave me, which was about a month ago, was that there's probably been 160,000 papers that have used GFP, because no one puts it in their title or their abstract or keywords or anything. It's just a tool now. But there's been really a remarkable thing in this the last 20 years since we published the paper. And I think more than anything else, that was the reason why GFP was given the prize. It was a prize in chemistry, so I've always thought that this was actually a prize to this really amazing molecule. In any case, it's been used in so many ways that I would never have imagined. People have used it to look at cancer metastasis in mice. It's not used in humans. Remember, you got to get the DNA into humans. Not really something that you're going to get approved for, right? So it's not something that people use in humans. But it has been used extensively to study disease processes that are found in humans. So, for example, people have studied cells in culture and asked how those cells transmit HIV by making the virus fluorescent. Now, the usual way we talk about, even in introductory biology at Columbia, when we talk about viruses infecting cells, usually we talk about bacterial viruses, and what these viruses do is they infect the cell, and then the cell explodes. And then the other cells, the cell lyses, and the other cells become infected. Well, if that were the case for something like HIV, then you might imagine that a vaccine would actually be pretty effective. Because when that virus is released, then the vaccine could come and bind to it, and hopefully that would be able to get rid of it. But what people found was that with HIV, that an infected cell went over to a non-infected cell, and the virus went from inside one cell to inside the other. It never went outside. So if it's not going outside, it's really hard to see how a vaccine, some antibodies, are going to affect it that much. Now, there could be other ways one could do it, but the basic transmission was looked at by looking at a GFP-labeled component. And lots of other human disease conditions have been studied in model organisms using GFP. I want to give one other example of really quite creative inventiveness by a guy named Bob Berlage. Bob was at Oak Ridge National Lab, and although he's never really published this, I'm not really sure why he didn't publish it. There was something about it maybe not working all the time, although a couple of other groups have found it sort of does work. There are some problems with it. So this is not a done project, but the idea is so spectacular that I want to talk about it. The idea is the following. He knew that there were bacteria that people had found that turned on genes in the presence of the explosive TNT. And so what he decided to do was to take that gene regulatory element that would be turned on by GFP, or turned on by TNT, and hook that up so whenever it was turned on, it would make green fluorescent protein instead. And so he'd have his bacteria, and he showed in a dish, put the bacteria in a dish, put TNT there, green bacteria. So because he was at Oak Ridge National Lab, he was allowed to get his hands on 5 landmines that had TNT in them, but were disconnected. They're not stupid scientists. So. And he had a friend bury the landmines in a 3 by 5 meter plot of land. And he went later and sprayed the area with his bacteria, and was able to come back with a UV lamp and actually see where the landmines had been leaking TNT, which is a characteristic of landmines. Now, the idea that one could use this as a way of identifying where these really horrible things that are left well after combatants leave the area, that maim children, innocent people in general, all the time, this is absolutely a wonderful idea. Unfortunately, probably the reason that the bacteria first got it is that they react probably to a plant protein or other thing that looks somewhat like TNT and then evolved to this thing of responding to TNT in the lab. They still respond to some plant proteins, so there's a little bit of a problem. But there's been other groups that have tried to put this in plants and other things, and people are still working on this. And I think, I mean, the basic thing is I don't think I can get the real information because I think the Army took over this project.
I'm actually working on this project in Dantis Lab on TNT, and it's funded by the Army. And we're doing something with ADHD, and I'm finding ADHD libraries who writers on display get this to work with that one specifically. But yeah.
So, Yeah, but I would imagine they would want to be on it. So I gave you that list at the beginning. I'm going to give you a different list now. I think you probably picked up all those things that were wrong about this. I'll say something about the genius part in a second. But I want to talk a little bit about what I think this research has taught me. So the first thing is that I think scientific success comes in a variety of routes. I think there's no right way to become a scientist or to succeed in science. We have Shimamura, who actually basically had a remarkable trajectory through all of this. Sam mentioned a little bit, well, I'll tell you Roger Chen. Roger Chen at 16 won the Westinghouse Talent Search Award. You know, this is now the Intel Science Talent Search thing. But he won that. He was designated as being brilliant from the beginning. In all of this. I never really show my college grades in chemistry. I did once, but it was only to a college reunion. But they are poor. let me say that. Sam mentioned that I did do some work in a lab over the summer after my junior year in college. And the experiments never worked. And no one told me that that was what happens usually, and not to be discouraged. I was completely discouraged. I dropped out of doing all of this. As he pointed out, I took the one course I needed to finish my major, and then I took a bunch of courses and things. I want to clarify one thing, though, because it actually led to a weird thing happening. I took a course on 20th century drama. I took a course on Dostoevsky. And I took a course on constitutional law, because they seemed interesting to me. One course in each. But at one point, I was asked about that time, and I said, I took courses in, and I meant one course in each of those areas. After the Nobel, I was invited to give a talk at a biophysics meeting in Genoa. And they said to me, do you mind if a reporter comes to interview you for the local paper? And I said, no, I don't mind. And I arrived in Genoa to find that the article had come out that morning. He had already written the article. And he had written it by reading Wikipedia and then writing it up. And he misunderstood the word courses, which he took to be the Italian word corso, meaning a course of study. So for a brief instant, in that part of Italy, I was known because I was an authority on Russian literature, an actor, and a lawyer. And then I decided to go into science. So it was actually very nice. But anyway, comes through a whole variety of routes. I seem to have stumbled through it and enjoyed it. Another point is that I think many, if not most, discoveries are accidental. That, in fact, if you look at the Nobels, because they're unique observations, things are changed. Most of those turn out, or not most, but many of those, because they change the way people are thinking, are often accidental. Not all of them, many of them are not, but a considerable number, somebody will be saying, we're trying this. In fact, It's actually, in order to have these accidents, you have to do a lot of experiments. So that's the sort of other side of this thing, is you just have to keep doing these things, but they do come up. I think it's very important to be either ignorant or stubborn or just have a willingness to try. If we had listened to people about what they thought GFP was, how it was going to work, we would have never done the experiments because it would have been too hard to find the converting enzyme and the thing. Although, in fairness, we did actually go and write up when I first wrote to Douglas about this. I said, well, we're going to try it, see if it works on its own. And if not, then we'll try to see what the converting thing is. But why the rest didn't work? Because no one knows why it works. We just know that when you add that other stuff, it cannot be expressed. There's something in those sequences, and no one's had the inclination or the time to actually go into that. So we really don't.
The protein isn't expressed, or
I think the protein is not expressed. Next point. Scientific progress is cumulative. This is not a story about me or about Osamu Shimomura or about Roger Chen or about my wife or Douglas Prescher. It's all of us and really the several hundred people that have worked on GFP. I want to say one more thing about this thing. There's I'm starting to call this a weekend experiment. This is a very important thing to do, which sort of puts both of these things together, and that is a weekend experiment is when you have this really lunatic idea, and you're completely embarrassed to say what the idea is to anyone, but you want to try it anyway. So you come in on Saturday morning, Saturday afternoon, Sunday morning, Sunday afternoon, sometime when people are not around, or you hope they're not around, and you do the experiment, and if it works, you crow about it on Monday, and if it doesn't work, you just ask people how their weekend went. But in any case, it's really important to do that, to just be willing to try things and have those accidents sometimes happen. So the other thing here is, as I said, scientific progress is cumulative. In this sense, I think of GFP as a pretty good metaphor for what we do as scientists. Because just as GFP takes in blue light and converts it to green light that it then emits, we take in the information and observations of other people, change it by our own experiments and thought, and then give it out to other people where it's converted to something else again. And it just keeps rolling like that. So it's really the thousands of people that have done this. This is going to sound like a plug, but it's not. It's actually a very important point that university and grant support was really essential. So let me explain why I think this is an important point and why I wish more people understood it. Columbia could care less of what I do. They really don't care what experiments I do. They'd like me to be successful if I want to stay, but they don't care what I do. That gave me an enormous amount of freedom to be able to work on anything I wanted and to take this chance to work on GFP. No one was there to tell me what to do. This is different from businesses, which have goals that they have to meet. And if those goals are not working or if the projects are not working, they can drop those and change what people are doing. People, sometimes they do have the freedom to do this, and they've made wonderful discoveries. But a lot of times, projects get dropped because they are not in line with where the business wants to go. The university didn't care. It gave me the freedom to do this work. Most of my research is funded by the National Institutes of Health, and I don't have a contract. I have a grant. That's the important distinction. A contract is when you say, I am going to do the following five things. And you should pay me because I'm going to do these five things. These are the things I'm going to produce. And so That's what you're paying for. That's not what a grant is. A grant says, here are the five things that right now I believe are the most important experiments I can do. And if you agree with me, fund me. But I'm going to tell you something. If tomorrow somebody comes up with a better way of doing the experiment, or we discover something else that I believe is more important and I can justify its importance, I'm not going to do these things. I'm going to do these other things. We never had a grant for GFP at all. And if you think about it, you write a grant and then you have to write another grant 4 or 5 years later. In that intervening time, what you wrote 4 or 5 years before is going to become incredibly out of date. So if you mindlessly stuck with doing the things you said, you would probably not be successful. So the funding through grant support and not a contract was really essential. We could see how it would help the project. We could see that it would be a very useful tool, and we took advantage of that. And that's the general thing. And I think lay audiences often think that what we're getting is contracts, that we're saying, I'm going to solve this disease, or I'm going to solve this, or I'm going to study this process, and that you deliver on what you say. There's a flexibility that actually allows for much greater discovery, and I think it's exceptionally important. The real heroes in all of this stuff are the students and the postdocs in the lab. When we let the news out that we had GFP working and it was a nice marker, and as I said, I put it in this Worm Breeders Gazette article, I started getting phone calls from all over the country, actually even outside the country, of people saying, and it was always the heads of the lab that called up, and they almost all said the same sentence. The sentence was, my graduate student or my postdoc has told me that you have something called green fluorescent protein and they want it for their experiments. Tell me what it is and why we should get it. And so I describe it and they say, yes, they're right. It was the students and the postdocs that were pushing the PIs to go get this material. Not all the time, sometimes PIs did this too, but a very large percentage of the time, it was the postdocs and the graduate students that were pushing because they could see it as a useful tool. And that's certainly the case in my lab. I'm just always sort of hanging on, trying to catch up to the people there. Next, this all starts, I mentioned the corals, there's been the various tools for what's called optogenetics that have come out of other organisms that are not traditional model organisms for people to study, but have proven to be very useful tools, and there'll be many more, and all sorts of interesting medicines as well. And the final point I want to make is that this is a story of basic research. Now, our work, we were trying to understand where genes were expressed, or my wife's experiments of where a protein was made in the cells. We were using it to study basic biological functions. And the spin-off of that has been the production of an exceptionally useful tool in many, many respects. And so there's a lot of talk these days about translational research. In fact, NIH has paid money to establish, last time I looked, there were 60 centers, one for every major medical school in the country, that I think just had a name change. All of these used to be the Institutes of Clinical Research, and now they're all called, 57 out of the 60 are called Institutes of Translational and Clinical Research. But the idea is that we should be putting our money towards finding cures and treatments. And that's what translational research is. Take all that stuff that these scientists at the bench don't really have the thoughts to what they should do with it, and show them how it's really important. Let's apply that to these cures. Now, as I get older, this idea of translation is really good because I'd like a lot of things to be sort of cured just like everybody else. But the fact of the matter is that this very narrow view of only looking at translational, that a last step is missing out on the fact that most of the breakthroughs that come in science with regard to medicine do not start with that translational aspect. So while translational experiments and ideas are exceptionally important, there should be a balance. I don't think the balance should be what happened when there was the stimulus money. The first thing that NIH did with the Obama stimulus money was to issue 100 challenges, 100 problems that they wanted to have solved. For those 100 areas, they got, I think it was 20,000 applications. They funded 4 in each of them, so they funded 400. So there were lots of applications. Of the 100, 98 were translational. 2 were basic. I think that's really the wrong balance here. And so this thing about basic research is important. Not because necessarily we're going to learn, you know, we're going to produce wonderful tools. We're going to also, but it has been the case that we have developed so many things because of the basic research. There's also an attitude, and this was actually said in about 2004 by the then head of the Cancer Institute at NIH, who was a physician, who actually got up in a room of scientists and said, "Don't we already know enough now so that we don't have to do any more basic research?" Which is sort of horrifying to everybody that heard it at the time. Since then and still now, the vast majority of genes that have been identified by the Human Genome Project are still labeled as making proteins of unknown function. We really just don't know what the parts are yet, to say nothing about how many real genes we have in humans or any other organism. So I want to end with my favorite quote about basic research. And this was said by Robert R. Wilson in 1969 to a joint committee of Congress that was debating the funding of what became the Fermi Labs in Batavia, Illinois, which until the CERN Super Collider came online a couple of years ago, was the biggest particle accelerator in the world. And incredible discoveries were made in it, including neutron radiation as a way of treating cancer. But the Congress was debating whether they wanted to pay for this big science project. And John Pastore, the senator from Rhode Island, had invited Wilson to come. Wilson became the first head of the lab. He also was the architect of the lab. And if you ever go there, you can see his sculptures that dot the whole thing. I mean, he's a really remarkable guy. There's one building called the Wilson Tower that he wanted as the central tower of the place for the meetings and offices and everything. And the story goes that he wanted an observation deck in the building that would oversee, you know, see all the area. And the way he determined how high that should be is he rented a helicopter and had the helicopter fly him up until he got to the right vantage point. And he said, "How high are we?" And he said, "Okay, we'll build the building up to that height." Rather remarkable guy. He's asked to this meeting in Congress, because remember, it's 1969, middle of the Vietnam War, lots of concerns about defense and national security. And he said, he was asked by Pastore, who was a friend of this, and he thought this would be a real easy question for him to answer, "How will this lab help us in the national defense? Can you tell me how many ways this will help in the national defense?" And Wilson said, "None." And he kept pushing, "Well, what about national security?" He kept saying, "Nope, there's none." And then finally, he got pushed a little too much. And the question, I think, was, "In what respect is this going to help our defense?" And Wilson said, "It has only to do with the respect with which we regard one another, the dignity of men, our love of culture. It has to do with whether we are good painters, good sculptors, great poets. I mean all the things we really venerate in our country and are patriotic about. It has nothing to do directly with defending the country, except to make it worth defending." So thank you, and I'll take questions.